Chapter 10, Bernie's Choice, Why Conscience is Better. Happiness is when what you think, what you say, and what you do are in harmony. Mahatma Gandhi. If you could be completely free of conscience, no moral scruples, and no guilt at all, what do you think you would do with your life? When I ask people this question, as I often have, the typical response is, "Oh, wow," or, "Oh, my goodness," followed by a silence during which they wrinkle their faces in mental effort, as if someone had asked them a question in a language they only half understood. Then most people grin or laugh, seemingly embarrassed by the authority of conscience in their lives, and reply with some version of, "I don't really know what I'd do, but I'm sure it wouldn't be what I'm doing now." After "oh wow" and a brief pause, one especially imaginative person chuckled and said, "Maybe I'd be the dictator of a small country or something." He said this as if such an ambition would have been smarter and more impressive than the socially valuable professional career he had in fact pursued. Would it be smarter not to have a conscience? Would we be happier? We know the groups of people would end up in trouble, whole nations of sociopaths, everyone out for himself or herself alone. But realistically, on a personal level, would you or I as individuals be happier and better off if we could shed the limitations of conscience? It would certainly seem so at times. Dishonest people hold positions of power, and corporate thieves purchase Gulf Streams and yachts, while we work responsibly and make sensible car payments. But what is the truth of the matter? From a psychological point of view, do sociopaths really have better lives than we do? Or is having a conscience somehow the happier fate? In an ironically utilitarian way, from the beginning, we were selected by nature to be social, sharing creatures, our very brains wired for emotional connectedness with one another, and for a sense of conscience. Or rather, all but a few of us took this path. Profiting from a different but equally business-like selection process, a few evolved as rogues, apathetic to their brother and sister human beings, with emotionally disconnected brains that hatched thoroughly selfish agendas. Judging from the vantage of the 21st century and looking through the eyes of psychology, which of these two ancient factions, the socially conscientious or the sociopathic, can we say got human nature's better deal? The losing side of winning. It would be difficult to refute the observation that people who are completely unhampered by conscience sometimes achieve power and wealth, at least for a while. Too many chapters in the human history book, from its first lines to its most contemporary entries, are organized around the stupendous successes of military invaders, conquerors, robber barons, and empire builders. Such individuals are either too long dead or too privileged to be formally evaluated in the fashion a clinical psychologist would like. But given certain of their well-known and highly documented behaviors, we assume, even without knowing their scores on the PD scale, that a fair number of them would not be found to possess any intervening sense of obligation based in emotional attachment to others. In other words, some of them were, and are, sociopaths. To make matters worse, brutal conquerors and empire builders are usually held in awe by their contemporaries, and during their lifetimes they are often seen as role models for the entire human race. No doubt countless 13th-century Mongol boys were put to bed with tales of the indomitable Genghis Khan, and one wonders which of the modern heroes we tout to our children will ultimately be remembered by history as motivated by ruthless self-interest. Sexual conquest also is served rather well by the absence of conscience. To illustrate this point, using the offspring of the same famous tyrant, Genghis Khan's eldest son, Tushi Khan, is said to have sired 40 sons via his birthright to pick from the most beautiful women of the conquered. The remainder of the vanquished, along with their sons, were routinely slaughtered. One of Genghis's many grandsons, Kublai Khan, founder of the Yuan dynasty, had 22 legitimate sons and added 30 virgins to his harem every year. And as of the time I write these words, virtually identical Y chromosomes are carried by almost 8% of the men living in the region of the former Mongol Empire, 16 million of them. Geneticists believe this means that some 16 million people living in the 21st century are stamped with Genghis Khan's 13th century legacy of genocide and rape. Genghis Khan was exceptional among sociopathic tyrants in that he did not die a violent or ignominious death. Instead, he fell off a horse during a hunt in 1227. By far, most perpetrators of genocide and mass rape eventually take their own lives or are killed, often by enraged followers who have had enough. Caligula was assassinated by one of his own guards. Hitler is believed to have put a pistol in his mouth, and his body is said to have been cremated with diesel fuel. Mussolini was shot, and his body hung by its heels in a public square. Romania's Nicolae Cosaco and his wife Elena were killed by a firing squad in 1989, on Christmas Day. Cambodia's Pol Pot died in a two-room hut, held prisoner by former associates, his body burned under a pile of garbage and rubber tires. Global sociopaths most typically come to no good end, and this sharply downward tendency is displayed by the more local ones as well. In the final analysis, sociopathy appears to be a losing game, regardless of its scale. Hannah's father, for example, lost everything that should have been precious to him. By the time he was 50, he had forfeited his job, his position in the community, his beautiful wife, and his loving daughter, all for the exhilaration of being a minor player in the heroin game. And in the end, he is likely to die from a bullet to his own head, from the gun of some other small-time criminal. Luke, my patient Sydney's deadbeat ex, also lost everything that was valuable. His wife, his son, and even his swimming pool. Super Skip, though he blithely deems himself to be too unassailable and too smart to be brought down by the likes of the Securities and Exchange Commission, probably will prove to be neither when the SEC finally sets upon him in earnest. Doctor Doreen Littlefield, even with a mind fully sharp enough to pursue a real PhD, will instead migrate as a fake to more and more obscure locations, playing the same tedious games with the decent people she envies, until she runs out of places to hide. By the time she is 50, her travels and her unchecked covetousness will have emptied her bank account and pinched her face into that of a bored 70-year-old. A list of such dreary endings could go on and on. Contrary to what seems to be a rather popular belief, acting ruthlessly does not, in the end, bring you more than your fair share of the good things in life. Quite the opposite. One might even say that for the extraordinarily patient observer, one technique to determine whether or not a questionable person is a genuine sociopath is to wait until the end of her life and witness whether or not she has ruined herself, partially or maybe even completely. Does she really possess what you would love to have in your life? Or instead, is she isolated, burned out, and bored? Is it perhaps stunning the way the mighty have fallen? Since we began to record wars, occupations, and projects of genocide, historians have often remarked that a certain type of catastrophic, amoral villain seems to be born over and over into the human race. No sooner are we rid of one than another appears somewhere else on the planet. From the point of view of population genetics, there is probably some truth to this legend. And since we do not understand these people, since their psychology is so alien to most of us, we often do not recognize or stop them until they have damaged humanity in unfathomable ways. But, as Gandhi pointed out with such wonder and relief, in the end, they always fall. Think of it, always. The same phenomenon occurs on smaller scales, too. Ordinary people without conscience visit pain on their families and communities, but in the end, they tend to self-destruct. Small-time sociopaths would survive long enough to dominate some of the others on our imaginary desert island, maybe promulgate some genes, but at the end of the day, they would probably be hung up by their heels. Part of the reason for this eventual failure is obvious, especially in cases where infamous despots, such as Mussolini or Pol Pot, have been killed and mutilated by angry ex-followers. If you oppress, rob, murder, and rape enough people, eventually some of them will gang up on you and take their revenge. We can see this in the much less epic story of Doreen Littlefield as well. The odds were always against her, and finally she just happened to make the wrong person mad. But there are additional reasons, less obvious, for the long-term failure of living without a conscience, reasons that are endemic to the psychology of sociopathy, rather than the rage of other people. And the first of these is boredom, plain and simple. Is that all there is? Though we know what boredom is, most normal adults do not experience sheer boredom very often. We are stressed, rushed, and worried, but we are seldom purely bored, in part because we are so stressed, rushed, and worried. Time, without anything we must attend to, usually feels like a breather, not like monotony. To get a feel for what sheer boredom is like, we must hearken back to childhood. Children and adolescents are frequently bored, so bored they can hardly even stand it. Their perfectly normal developmental need for constant stimulation, for exploring and ongoing learning, is often thwarted in a world of long trips, rainy afternoons, and study halls. In children, boredom can be excruciating, like a chronic spiritual headache or a powerful thirst with no beverage to be had. It can hurt so bad that the poor kid feels like yelling out loud or throwing something noisy at a wall. Extreme boredom is arguably a form of pain. Lucky for us, adults do not have the same need for constant stimulation. Despite our stresses, we tend to live with a fairly manageable window of arousal, neither unbearably overstimulated nor understimulated, except for sociopaths. People who are sociopaths report that they crave extra stimulation almost continually. Some use the word addicted, as in addicted to thrills, addicted to risk. Such addictions occur because the best, maybe the only, consistent cure for understimulation is our emotional life, so much so that in many psychology texts, the terms arousal and emotional response are used almost interchangeably. We are stimulated by our meaningful ties to, negotiations with, and happy and unhappy moments alongside other people, and sociopaths do not have this emotional life to live. They do not experience the sometimes harrowing, sometimes thrilling, ever-present arousal that unavoidably attends genuine attachments to other people. Laboratory experiments using electric shocks and loud noises have found that even the physiological reactions, sweating, racing heart, and so forth, normally associated with anxious anticipation and learned fear, are far less pronounced in sociopaths. For adequate stimulation, sociopaths have only their games of domination, and these games get old and stale very quickly. Like drugs, the games have to be done over and over, larger and better, and depending on the resources and talents of the particular sociopath, this may not be possible. And so in sociopathy, the pain of boredom can be nearly constant. The inclination to dilute boredom chemically for a while is part of the reason sociopaths tend to be alcohol and drug abusers. A major comorbidity study published in 1990 in the Journal of the American Medical Association estimates that as many as 75% of sociopaths are dependent on alcohol, and 50% abuse other drugs. And so sociopaths are often addicts in the usual sense, in addition to being figuratively addicted to risk. With its peak experiences and its dangers, the drug culture holds more than one form of appeal for the conscienceless. And the drug culture is where many sociopaths feel most at home. Another study, published in 1993 in the American Journal of Psychiatry, found that 18% of intravenous drug abusers diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder were HIV positive, where only 8% of intravenous drug abusers without antisocial personality disorder tested positive for HIV. The higher odds ratio of HIV infection among sociopaths is presumably due to their greater risk-taking behaviors. These statistics bring us back to a question I posed in the first chapter. Is the absence of conscience an adaptive condition, or is it a mental disorder? One operational definition of mental disorder is any psychological condition that causes substantial life disruption, which is to say, serious and unusual limitations in a person's ability to function as well as might be expected, given that person's overall health and level of intelligence. Common sense tells us that the presence of any of the recognized mental disorders, major depression, chronic anxiety, paranoia, and so forth, would likely cause woeful life disruption. But what about the absence of something we usually regard as a strictly moral trait? What about the absence of conscience? We know that sociopaths almost never seek treatment, but do they suffer life disruption nonetheless? A way of approaching this issue is to consider what is meaningful in life to the sociopath, winning and domination, and then to ponder the following odd question. Why are all sociopaths not in positions of great power? Given their focused motivation and granted the freedom of action that results from having no conscience whatsoever, they should all be formidable national leaders or international CEOs, or at least high-ranking professionals or dictators of small countries. Why do they not win all the time? For they do not. Instead, most of them are obscure people and limited to dominating their young children or a depressed spouse or perhaps a few employees or co-workers. Not an insignificant number of them are in jail like Hannah's father or in danger for their careers or their lives. Very few are fabulously wealthy like Skip. Even fewer are famous. Having never made much of a mark on the world, the majority are on a downward life course, and by late middle age will be burned out completely. They can rob and torment us, temporarily, yes, but they are, in effect, failed lives. From a psychologist's point of view, even the ones in prestigious positions, even the ones with famous names, are failed lives. For most of us, happiness comes through the ability to love, to conduct our lives according to our higher values, most of the time, and to feel reasonably contented within ourselves. Sociopaths cannot love. By definition, they do not have higher values, and they almost never feel comfortable in their own skins. They are loveless, amoral, and chronically bored, even the few who become rich and powerful. And they are uncomfortable in their skins for more reasons than boredom. The absolute self-involvement of sociopathy creates an individual consciousness that is aware of every little ache and twitch in the body, every passing sensation in the head and chest, and ears that orient with acute personalized concern to every radio and television report about everything from bedbugs to ricin. Because his concerns and awareness are geared exclusively toward himself, the person without conscience sometimes lives in a torment of hypochondriacal reactions that would make even the most fretful anxiety, neurotic, appear rational. Getting a paper cut is a major event, and a cold sore is the beginning of the end. Perhaps the most famous historical example of the sociopath's obsession with his body is Adolf Hitler, who was a lifelong hypochondriac with an overpowering fear of developing cancer. In an attempt to keep cancer at bay and to cure a long list of other imaginary health problems, he swallowed remedies formulated specially by his favorite personal physician, Dr. Theodore Morell. Many of these tablets contained hallucinogenic toxins. In this way, Hitler gradually poisoned himself into actual illness. Most likely, on account of this, a tremor, a real one, in his right hand became conspicuous, and by mid-1944, he was disallowing photographs. Sociopaths sometimes use their hypochondriasis as a strategy to get out of doing work. One moment they are fine, but then it is time to pay the bills, or look for a job, or help a friend move to a new apartment, and suddenly they have chest pains or a limp. And imaginary medical concerns and infirmities often secure special treatment, such as the one last chair in an overcrowded room. In general, there is an aversion to sustained effort and organized projects of work, and of course, this preference for ease is extremely self-limiting where success in the real world is concerned. Getting up every single morning and working for a long succession of hours is almost never considered. Sociopaths feel that the easy scheme, the one-shot deal, or the clever ambush is much to be preferred over day-to-day commitment to a job, a long-term goal, or a plan. Even when sociopaths are found in high-status jobs, these positions tend to be those in which the amount of actual hard work done, or not, can be easily obscured, or where others can be manipulated into being the real workers. In such settings, a smart sociopath can sometimes keep things going with an occasional splashy performance, or by schmoozing and being charming, or by being intimidating. She poses herself as the absentee supervisor, or the rainmaker, or the invaluable high-strung genius. She requires frequent vacations, or sabbaticals, in which her actual activities are somewhat mysterious. Sustained work, the true key to lasting success, keeping one's nose to the grindstone, tolerating tedium, seeing to the details, is a little too close to responsibility. Sadly, this same self-limiting factor tends to apply even to sociopaths who were born with special gifts and talents. The kind of intense commitment and daily work required to develop and promote one's art, one's music, or any other creative project is typically impossible for a sociopath. If success can be acquired fortuitously, with only episodic input, then perhaps. But if the art requires a prolonged personal investment, it is lost. In the end, a person without conscience has the same relationship to her own gifts as she does to other people. She does not take care of them. And sociopathy is almost always a solo routine, another strategy that may sometimes work temporarily, but not often in the long run. For the obvious reason of unremitting self-interest, people without conscience make lousy team players. The sociopath is out for himself alone. When he deals with another person or with a group of people, he attempts to do so by lies, flattery, and the creation of fear. These approaches to success are far weaker and more short-lived than our genuine relating, leadership, and personal involvement, and goals that might have been reached in a partnership or in a sustained group effort are usually scuttled by the sociopath's exclusive concern with himself. This path to ultimate failure is typically taken by infamous tyrants, as well as by countless, less publicized sociopathic employers, co-workers, and spouses. When the thrill of manipulating other people takes over, as it does in sociopathy, all other objectives are eclipsed, and the resulting life disruption, though of a different sort, can be just as severe as the limitations imposed by major depression, chronic anxiety, paranoia, and other mental illnesses. And the emotional bankruptcy of sociopathy means that the sociopath is forever deprived of an authentic emotional intelligence, a capacity for understanding how people work, that is an irreplaceable guide for living in the human world. Like Doreen, who actually believes she can increase her personal power by diminishing others, like Skip, who imagines himself permanently immune to society and its rules, like the defeated dictator, who is bewildered because the hate-filled mob composed of his people will not allow him to negotiate. A person without conscience, even a smart one, tends to be a short-sighted and surprisingly naive individual who eventually expires of boredom, financial ruin, or a bullet. Extreme conscience. Still, the most compelling reason for desiring to have conscience, rather than wishing to be free of it, is not the list of ruinous disadvantages that accrue to sociopathy. No, the best part of possessing a moral sense is the deep and beautiful gift that comes to us inside, and only inside, the wrappings of conscience. The ability to love comes bundled up in conscience, just as our spirits are bundled up in our bodies. Conscience is the embodiment of love, imbued into our very biology. It lives in the part of the brain that reacts emotionally, and in their favor, when the ones we love need our attention, our help, or even our sacrifice. We have already seen that when someone's mind is not equipped to love, he can have no genuine conscience either, since conscience is an intervening sense of responsibility based in our emotional attachments to others. Now we turn this psychological equation around. The other truth is that should a person have no conscience, he could never truly love. When an imperative sense of responsibility is subtracted from love, all that is left is a thin, tertiary thing, a will to possess, which is not love at all. Just after September 11, 2001, even as an especially dark and aggressive chapter in our history began, my psychologist friend Bernie told me without hesitation that he would choose conscience over the apparent expediency of being without conscience, but that he could not articulate why. I believe Bernie's intuitive preference was due to the inextricable link between conscience and the ability to love, and that if given the choice between all the power, fame, and money in the world and the privilege of loving his own children, Bernie would choose the latter in a heartbeat. In part, this is because Bernie is a good person. Also, this is because Bernie is a good psychologist, and he knows something about what actually makes people happy. There is the will to possess and to dominate, and then there is love. Whether or not he could express his reasons at that moment in choosing conscience, Bernie, the psychologist, effectively chose love, and this does not surprise me. Dominating can constitute a temporary thrill, but it does not make people happy. Loving does. But is it not possible to have too much conscience? Are there not psychologists who have said that, far from happiness, people can be tyrannized and driven into serious depression by their consciences? Yes and no. Freud observed that an overactive superego could bully its owner into depression and possibly even suicide. But superego, that yammering disciplinary voice internalized from our early experiences, is not conscience. Neither is something that psychologists call unhealthy shame, which is not really shame in the sense of a reaction to having committed bad deeds, so much as it is the irrational belief instilled by negative messages in childhood that one's whole self is somehow bad, repellent, worthless. Even a little unhealthy shame is too much, but unhealthy shame is hardly normal conscience, which is an intervening sense of responsibility and not an intrusive feeling of worthlessness and calamity. When contemporary psychologists say that too much conscience is toxic, their vocabulary is careless. They are referring instead to unhealthy shame or to a strident superego working overtime. Conscience, our seventh sense, is a different phenomenon altogether. It is a feeling of obligation based in love. So the question lingers, is extreme conscience debilitating or elevating? To understand what a great deal of conscience does to the psyche, we can observe the lives and the happiness level of people who have developed their innate sense of conscience into an especially powerful emotional muscle. Each one of us might name different individuals as our moral heroes, from historical or public figures to people we have known personally who have impressed us with their moral commitment. In a systematic study of such people, Ann Colby of Radcliffe's Henry Murray Research Center and William Damon of Brown University's Department of Education made choices of their own. Concerned about what they perceived as our current scarcity of moral leadership, Colby and Damon selected 23 individuals whom they considered to be moral exemplars, 11 men and 12 women whose moral commitment has resulted in single contributions in many areas, including civil rights and civil liberties, the reduction of poverty and hunger, religious freedom, environmental protection, and peace. These 23 people are diverse in terms of race, religion, socioeconomic status, and specific goals, but all have one thing in common, an extraordinarily powerful sense of conscience, an overdeveloped sense that they are responsible for the welfare of their fellow human beings. They represent, from a psychologist's vantage point, the diametric emotional and mental opposite of the sociopaths we have been discussing. Colby and Damon's moral exemplars include Virginia Foster Dyer, the Southern belle turned civil rights activist, who was the first person to hug Rosa Parks when she stepped out of jail. Susie Valadez, who has spent many years feeding, clothing, and providing medical care to thousands of poor Mexicans in Ciudad Juarez. Jack Coleman, a former president of Haverford College, noted for his blue-collar sabbaticals as a ditch digger, a garbage man, a homeless person. Businessman Cabell Brand, who devoted himself to the creation of Total Action Against Poverty in Roanoke, Virginia. And Charles Zeta Wattles, founder of the Perpetual Mission, who dedicated her life to helping the elderly and the poor, the unwed mothers, the prostitutes, and the abused children of Detroit, Michigan. The researchers studied autobiographies and oral histories and conducted in-depth interviews with each of the 23 exemplars and their co-workers. In a book that documents their findings, entitled Some Do Care, Contemporary Lives of Moral Commitment, they report three striking commonalities among individuals of extreme conscience. The authors label these shared characteristics as 1. Certainty, 2. Positivity, and 3. Unity of self and moral goals. Certainty refers to an exceptional clarity concerning what the exemplars believe to be right, and also their sense of unequivocal personal responsibility to act on those beliefs. Positivity expresses the exemplars' affirmative approach to life, their extraordinary enjoyment of their work, and their marked optimism, often despite hardship or even danger. And unity of self and moral goals describes the integration of the subject's moral stance with their conception of their own identity and the perceived sameness of their moral and personal goals. Unity means that, for such people, conscience is not just a guiding light, it is who they are. In an attempt to describe his sense of personal identity, one of the exemplars, Cabell Brand, explained in an interview, "Who I am is what I am able to do and how I feel all the time, each day, each moment. It's hard for me to separate who I am from what I want to do and what I am doing." Colby and Damon consider this third characteristic, the unity of self and moral goals, to be their most important finding, and crucially important to the understanding of conscience and its effects. When conscience grows sufficiently strong, apparently it unifies the human psyche in a unique and beneficial way, and rather than causing life disruption, extreme conscience significantly enhances life satisfaction. Colby and Damon write, "Our exemplars have been invulnerable to the debilitating effects of privation because all they have needed for personal success is the productive pursuit of their moral mission. In unself-conscious defiance of our cultural tendency to set conscience and self-interest in opposition to each other, Colby and Damon's exemplars defined their own welfare and self-interest in moral terms and were, with very few exceptions, extremely happy and fulfilled. Far from causing them suffering or making them into dupes, their exceptional sense of obligation to other people made them happy. Conscience, our sense of responsibility toward one another, allows us to live together, in our homes and on our planet. It helps to create meaning in our lives and stands between us and an empty existence of meaningless competitions. A very large sense of conscience can integrate moral intention, personal desire, and identity in the mind. Right action becomes who we are. And for this reason, extreme conscience appears to be a rare, exact fit key to human happiness. So, here is my best psychological advice. As you look around our world and try to figure out what is going on and who is winning, do not wish to have less conscience. Wish for more. Celebrate your fate. Having a conscience, you may never be able to do exactly as you please, or just what you would need to do in order to succeed easily or ultimately in the material world. And so perhaps you will never wield great financial or political power over other people. Maybe you will never command the respect of the masses or their fear. On the contrary, you may suffer painful bouts of conscience that cause you to act quite against your own self-serving ambitions. And you may have to work hard all your life, giving up the temptations of childlike dependency because you want your own children to thrive. You may yourself be caught up in the snares of sociopaths from time to time, and on account of your scruples, you may never be able to take satisfactory revenge on the people who have hurt you. And yes, you may never become the dictator of a small country. But you will be able to look at your children asleep in their beds and feel that unbearable surge of awe and thanksgiving. You will be able to keep others alive in your heart long after they are gone. You will have genuine friends. Unlike the hollow, risk-pursuing few who are deprived of a seventh sense, you will go through your life fully aware of the warm and comforting, infuriating, confusing, compelling, and sometimes joyful presence of other human beings. And along with your conscience, you will be given the chance to take the largest risk of all, which, as we all know, is to love. Conscience truly is Mother Nature's better bargain. Its value is evident on a grand historic scale, and as we will see in the next chapter, it is precious to us, even in our ordinary day-to-day dealings with friends and neighbors. Along with an entire neighborhood, let us now try to spend a day with an unfortunate and sociopathic woman named Tilly. From Tilly, we can learn, though she never will, that conscience makes everyday experience worth having. Chapter 11. Groundhog Day. What is not good for the swarm is not good for the bee. Marcus Aurelius. Tilly is someone personality theorist Theodore Millon would call an abrasive psychopath. She is sociopathic, but regrettably for Tilly, she lacks the sociopath's customary charm and finesse. Instead, to use Millen's words, she acts in an overtly and directly contentious and quarrelsome way, and everything and everyone is an object available for nagging and assaulting. Tilly's specific talent is to take the smallest, subtlest whisper of conflict and amplify it into a shouting match. She excels at the creation of hostility and bitterness, where there was none before, and specializes in provoking people who ordinarily are gentle and peace-loving. In Tilly's universe, Tilly is always right, and she takes self-righteous pleasure in opposing and frustrating her opponents, who are seemingly everywhere and somehow always wrong. Her mission in life is to correct the world, a calling she heeds without hesitation or conscience. In this mission, she perceives that she is unappreciated by others, which further justifies her behavior toward them. This morning, Tilly has discovered a groundhog in her backyard. As she watches from her sunroom, it sits back on its round haunches in the grass and turns its alert little face in every direction, as if surveying Tilly's property. When Tilly opens the sliding door to get a better look, the animal freezes in place for a moment, then waddles away and vanishes into the ground at the edge of the lawn, at a point where Tilly's yard meets that of her neighbors, Catherine and Fred. Tilly makes a mental note of where its hole must be, then goes out to stand on her deck, a white-haired woman of 70 in a blue checkered house dress, appearing for all the world to be the archetypal kind and wise old woman. As she gazes with interest across the lawn, anyone looking on might remark that her demeanor and bottom-heavy shape are not altogether different from the groundhog's. Tilly's neighbors on the other side of her house and up the hill, Greta and Jerry, also happen to be having breakfast in their sunroom, and can see Tilly there on her deck. They are too far away to notice the groundhog. All they can make out is 70-year-old Tilly, standing very still in her blue and white dress. 35-year-old Greta, the manager of a local department store, says to her husband Jerry, a building contractor, "Damn, I wish that awful woman would just move away. How long has she been here now?"
15 months, replies Jerry.
Greta smiles mirthlessly. "But who's counting, right? I know I shouldn't wish people gone, but she's just so incredibly mean and controlling. I don't know how she can even stand her own self."
Jerry sighs and says, "Maybe we could buy her out."
Greta is about to laugh, and then she realizes that Jerry is not joking. All of a sudden, she understands that her normally even-tempered husband despises Tilly every bit as much as she does. She feels chilly and a little guilty, and goes back into the kitchen to get some more hot coffee. When she comes back, Jerry is still staring at the old woman on her deck. He says, "No, we really can't afford to buy her out. Maybe she'll just move. Seems like you'd move if everybody in the neighborhood hated you as much as everybody hates her." Greta points out, "Well, the thing is, I bet she gets this reaction wherever she goes."
"Yeah, probably. Where was she living before?"
"Don't know," answers Greta. Then, beginning to feel somewhat gratified that Jerry shares her sentiments, she says, "Do you believe this? It was last week, I think, she called me and said we shouldn't have any more fires in our fireplace. She's allergic to wood smoke, don't you know?"
"What? You never told me she did that. That's crazy."
Jerry clenches his fists and then changes his assessment.
"No, that's not crazy. That's just horse crap. We'll have a fire in the damn fireplace tonight. In fact, I'll bring in some more wood before I leave for work."
"But it's supposed to get really warm today."
"Who cares?"
This time Greta does laugh. "Do you know how we sound?" Jerry looks at his wife sheepishly, and the corners of his mouth begin to turn up. He unclenches his fists and cracks his knuckles a couple of times to get rid of the tension. Greta and Jerry's neighbor across the street and down three houses is an elderly widow named Sunny. At this very moment, though she cannot actually see Tilly on her back deck like Greta and Jerry can, Sunny, too, is thinking about how mean Tilly is. Yesterday, Tilly called the police because Sunny had parked her car on the street in front of her own house. Sunny has always parked her car in that big space between the street and her house since her husband passed away 10 years ago, because she is afraid to back out of her driveway into the traffic. The young policeman came and made her put it in the driveway. He apologized several times, but still he said Tilly was right. It was a violation. Sunny has not even had breakfast yet, and already she is dreading her trip to the grocery store today, because she will have to back her car out alone. She feels like crying. And that car was nowhere near Tilly's house. As Sunny laments across the street, Tilly, on her backyard deck, decides that the groundhog is not going to reappear right now. She goes back into her house, where she can no longer be seen by the breakfasting Greta and Jerry up the hill. While Greta and Jerry drink the rest of their coffee and try to talk about something else, Tilly, in her kitchen, picks up the phone and calls Catherine, the next-door neighbor with whom she now shares a groundhog. Catherine teaches the sixth grade. She has taught school since she was 22, and now her 60th birthday is coming. She thinks she ought to retire, but the notion only makes her sad. Her teaching, her kids, mean the world to her, and she really does not want to stop working. Her husband, Fred, who is 7 years older and already retired, understands this and is patient with her. "Whenever you're ready," he always says. "I like to putter around the house and fix things anyway." And then they both laugh. Fred can barely replace burned-out light bulbs. Until he reluctantly gave up the mantle a year ago, he was the editor of their regional newspaper. He is a good, quiet, bookish man who loved his work too, and still continues an emeritus human interest column called People You Should Know. When the phone rings, Fred is reading in the living room and Catherine is in the kitchen, getting ready to go to work early. The trill of the phone at such an hour makes Catherine jump. She answers it quickly. "Hello?" "Catherine," says Tilly abruptly, snipping the word as if she were angry. "Yes, this is Catherine. Tilly? Tilly, my goodness, it's 7 a.m. Are you all right?"
"Yes, I'm fine. I just saw a groundhog in the yard, and I thought you'd like to know."
"A what? A groundhog?"
"Yes, in the back, between our properties."
"Well, that's interesting. Must have been cute, I guess. Was it?"
"I suppose. Anyway, I know you're busy. I just thought you should know about the animal. We can talk about it later. Goodbye."
Right. Talk later. Well, goodbye then, Tilly." Catherine hangs up the phone, baffled, and Fred calls to her. "What was that?" She walks into the living room, where he sits with his book, and answers, "That was Tilly." "Ugh," says Fred, rolling his eyes. "What did she want?" "She wanted to tell me she saw a groundhog in the backyard."
"Why did she want to tell you that?"
Catherine shakes her head slowly and says, "I don't have the slightest idea."
"Ah, Tilly,"
pronounces Fred, raising his right arm above his head in mock salute. As she finishes her morning routine, Catherine feels confused and slightly ill at ease, knowing that with Tilly there is always a thickening plot, and that the denouement is likely to be controlling and upsetting. But for the life of her, she cannot imagine what this thing with the groundhog is about. Does Tilly want to have it removed? Is Tilly asking her permission in some roundabout way? Also, Catherine and Fred have lived in this same house for 30 years, and they have never once seen a groundhog in the yard. How odd. As she is about to leave for school, the phone rings a second time. She thinks it must be Tilly again, but instead it is another neighbor, sweet, soft-spoken Sonny, and she is in tears. Sonny tells Catherine that Tilly has made her park her car in the driveway, and now she is trapped. Can someone help? Can Catherine and Fred take her to the store today? Learning about this newest exploit of Tilly's, Catherine feels the blood rushing angrily to her face, but in her calmest voice, she reassures Sonny that, of course, Fred will drive her to the store. How about lunchtime? Also, Fred knows the chief of police very well, and maybe something can be done about the problem with Sonny's parking space. Teaching her class of sixth graders all day, Catherine forgets about Tilly, but when she gets home at about 4:30, she remembers the early morning phone call and begins to feel uneasy all over again. She was planning to take a nap before dinner, but as she sits down on the bed, her uneasiness gets suddenly stronger, and she is drawn to the window. The bedroom is on the second floor, and from here, Catherine has a clear view of the whole backyard, and Tilly's as well. The day has been unseasonably warm, and all those nice forsythias Fred planted at the back edge of their yard are beginning to bloom. There is the wide back lawn, and beyond that, the long row of little yellow forsythia blossoms, and then the gray-brown shadow of the still leafless conservation forest that borders all the backyards on this side of the street. And also, rather strangely, there is Tilly, standing right in the middle of her lawn. She is still wearing her checkered blue and white dress and has added a wide-brimmed straw hat, as if she were about to do some ladylike gardening. But Tilly never gardens. As Catherine watches from her bedroom window, Tilly looks around the yard, seems to spy something she wants, and marches over to it. She bends, and with obvious effort, lifts an object from the ground that looks to Catherine like a large white rock, about the size and shape of a small watermelon. Studying the scene more intently, Catherine realizes that the object is indeed a rock, a small boulder, really, and nearly too much for Tilly to hold. But Tilly embraces the rock with both arms, stooping in a way that is painful to watch, and begins to waddle unsteadily in the direction of Fred's forsythia plants. A phrase from the morning's phone conversation echoes in Catherine's head, "In the back, between our properties." And in the same moment, Catherine knows exactly what Tilly is doing. The groundhog's burrow. Tilly is going to use that rock to plug up the den of the groundhog she told her about. Catherine is appalled. She feels lightheaded and sick, almost as if she were witnessing a murder. She needs to do something, but going out and confronting Tilly directly would be like arguing with a rabid wolverine. In truth, though Catherine does not like to admit this to herself, Tilly frightens her in general, for reasons she cannot even put into words. Why should a rather insignificant 70-year-old woman frighten her? And how did Tilly know she would be watching from the house right now? Did she know? Catherine begins to pace across the bedroom, from the window to the old oak dresser and back to the window. She sees Tilly drop the rock clumsily onto a spot just beyond the forsythias, midway between two small willows at the edge of the woods, and she marks the location carefully in her mind. Then she paces back to the dresser and stares at herself in the antique mirror. While Tilly swipes at loose dirt on the front of her dress and parades back across the lawn to her deck, Catherine continues to stare into her own eyes in the mirror. "That poor little animal," she keeps thinking. "What if he's trapped?" Finally, Catherine knows what she wants to do, and she must tell Fred. He can help. Fred has been at the newspaper, visiting with some of his old friends. When he comes home, Catherine tells him what Tilly has done. He says, "Well, I guess in this case, Tilly got two with one stone, literally." "What do you mean?"
"You and the little woodchuck, both."
"Oh, right, that's really true, isn't it?" says Catherine glumly.
"It would appear so. Sure you don't want me to go over there and have it out with her?"
"No, she'd just do it again. I want to help the groundhog so he'll be okay. Go with me?"
"Do I have a choice?"
Catherine smiles and hugs him. "Not really," she says. They make dinner together, as is their habit, and wait until about 9 o'clock, when it is completely dark outside. Fred suggests flashlights, but Catherine thinks Tilly would see them. She'll know we liberated him, and she'll just cover him again tomorrow.
"We'll have to take at least one to find the burrow once we get there."
"Yes, right. Okay, maybe a penlight, for when we get there." They set out across the yard at a snail's pace, so as not to trip in the darkness. Fred takes the lead, and Catherine follows, arms held out in front of her like a sleepwalker's to keep her balance. When they get to the far end of the lawn, they follow along the row of forsythia bushes until there are no more forsythias. Then, in wonder, like a child, Catherine takes a step into the even more complete darkness beyond, hoping that her hands, and not her face, will find one of the willows. She feels a branch, takes a deep breath, and whispers, "Okay, Fred, penlight." Fred takes the light out of his pocket, holds it close to the ground, and turns it on. After a few moments, they find the melon-sized rock, somewhat more easily than they could have hoped, because the rock is smooth and white, and the surrounding earth is dark. Catherine exhales and pushes a loose strand of hair behind her left ear. She and Fred bend down and lift the rock together, revealing a surprisingly small hole in the ground, considering it is used by a fat little groundhog. Catherine has an impulse to shine the penlight into the hole to check on its occupant. But then she realizes that she will not see much, and that she may scare the animal. Arm in arm, whispering and containing their laughter, she and Fred stumble home. Tilly does not see them. As they return from their mission, she has already been drinking and sulking for several hours as usual. She sits on a sofa in her living room and pours herself glasses of Glenlivet, trying to drown out the monotony of her life and the idiots she continually has to deal with. The only thing that makes this evening different from any other is the accumulation of packing boxes now stacked around her. Inside her drunken fog, she congratulates herself on her brilliant idea not to put up a for sale sign this time. She thinks, "I'll take these cretins by surprise. Their stupid mouths will gape."
The good-for-nothing real estate agent keeps telling her that not using a sign is shooting herself in the foot, and that he really thinks she should wait for a higher offer. This buyer came in under her price. But Tilly cannot wait. She has never liked waiting. She will have her moment, and her moment will be tomorrow morning. And then everyone in this whole horrible neighborhood will be in complete shock about her move. She is sure of it. The agent does not understand why secrecy matters, but he is a fool, so why listen to him? She has taken losses before when she wanted to get out of the house fast. It's all in the game, she thinks to herself. All in the game. You can't stay in a place where the people won't listen to you, and giving them a parting shot is extremely important. Tilly has a trust fund from her deceased father that has supported her for most of her life. These days, she says she is retired, but she never really worked. She used to paint watercolors sometimes when she was younger, but she never sold any of them. She would like to purchase grander houses, but her wretched mother keeps hanging on, and so she cannot get her hands on the rest of the money. Her mother is nearly 100 years old, and still she has not died. Tilly is stuck in these dreadful middle-class neighborhoods, knowing that by rights she should have a wealthier lifestyle. She visits her mother periodically, because she certainly does not want to be written out of the will, and the bedridden old woman always reminds her of a half-plucked parakeet squawking in a cage. What she has to say is just about that interesting. Nothing is very interesting, really. Suffocating the rodent was okay for a few minutes, and she hopes Catherine was watching. Catherine would have a stroke. But then that project was over, and there was nothing else to do. She cannot imagine what these absurd people on all sides of her do that seems to occupy them so completely as they scurry about their little lives. They must have brains the size of peas. She pours herself another drink and consumes it in one gulp. Not yet packed into a box, a painting that she made when she was still in her 20s hangs over the unused fireplace, so faded that the image can hardly be made out in the shadows of the ill-lighted living room. Hunched on the sofa, she looks up at it and dimly recalls the beach scene she stood in all those decades ago. Then all she sees are the pinpoints of stars before her eyes that she waits for most nights of her life, just before she blacks out. The next morning is Saturday, a bit cooler than yesterday, and not a cloud in the sky. Across the street and down a few houses, Sunny opens the lace curtains in her front window, and as the sun streams in, she takes in the happy view of her car parked where it is supposed to be, on the street. And there it will stay parked. Fred talked to the police chief yesterday after lunch and got everything all squared away for her. Freedom, she breathes to herself. She tries to think what she can do for Fred and Catherine. Maybe she can bake them something. Imagining how much they will like that, she feels even more cheerful. In the house up the hill, Greta has the weekend off, and she and Jerry sleep late. When they slowly rouse themselves and go out to the sunroom to drink their coffee, they notice a big moving truck in Tilly's driveway.
"Does that mean what I think it means?" Jerry asks, staring at the truck. "Or are we still in bed dreaming?"
"Gotta be dreaming," says Greta, also staring. "I never saw a sign. Did you ever see a sign over there?"
"Nope."
Just now, two men wearing canvas coveralls come out of Tilly's house, each carrying one end of a sofa. Greta and Jerry look at each other and begin to laugh. Jerry laughs so hard he spills some of his coffee. Greta asks him, "Why do you suppose she kept it a secret?"
"Why does she do anything? But it doesn't matter anymore, does it? Unbelievable."
Greta is thoughtful for a moment and then says, "How old do you suppose she is?"
"I don't know. Not young."
"I wonder whether she ever had any children. Oh, wow, can you imagine being one of her children?"
"Worse yet, can you imagine being her?"
"So do you think we should feel sorry for her?" Greta asks. Jerry grins and waves his hand dismissively at the furniture-moving scene in the distance.
"Well, I'm not sure, sweetheart, but if we're going to feel sorry for her, let's do it over breakfast, okay? Remember that strudel?"
"Yes," says Greta, smacking her lips. She picks up both coffee mugs, and they abandon the view from the sunroom in favor of the pastry in the kitchen. Since they are in the house next door to Tilly's, Catherine and Fred also notice the activities of the men from the moving truck and wonder why they never saw a for sale sign or heard from Tilly that she was moving. Fred rolls his eyes again, and Catherine shakes her head.
But then they are distracted by another phone call, this one from their daughter and son-in-law, who say that in 2 weeks, they and 4-year-old Katie are flying out for another visit. Catherine is beside herself with excitement, and Tilly's moving day, still in progress outside, is forgotten. 2 hours later, when the truck pulls away from Tilly's house, no one is watching. All is quiet again. In Catherine and Fred's backyard, by the forsythias at the far opposite end of the row, the groundhog clambers out of his second hole and stands up as tall as he can on his short hind legs. His black eyes glinting in the bright sunlight, he peers over at a big white rock lying near his first hole, at the other end of the yellow bushes. Then he gazes up toward Tilly's empty house. Finally, his attention settles on a patch of dandelions growing in the soft earth just in front of him. Another groundhog, slightly smaller, wiggles out of the hole. They sit down, groundhog fashion, share a leisurely luncheon of new stems, and amble off into the woods. Chapter 12. Conscience in its purest form. Science votes for morality. He is not a perfect Muslim who eats his fill and lets his neighbor go hungry. Muhammad. For what shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Jesus. The man who knows how to split the atom but has no love in his heart becomes a monster. Krishnamurti. One way or another, a life without conscience is a failed life. Those of us who love and have conscience are really very lucky, even as we go about our everyday lives of work, reflexive give and take, and ordinary pleasures. And usually conscience is just that, reflexive and ordinary. Without fanfare and mostly without being noticed, conscience grants little bits of meaning to our normal and spontaneous day-to-day interactions with everyone and everything around us. Catherine and Fred were not thinking about high-minded principles when they set out to liberate the groundhog, which, as it turns out, was not trapped in the first place. They were not being pious or courageous, not particularly effective, and certainly not rational. It was simply that trying to help the animal seemed right and somehow made them feel good. Moving that rock was, to use an old and universally understood expression, good for their souls. Where conscience is concerned, over the centuries Western culture has progressed from faith in an immutable God-sent knowledge of right and wrong to a belief in Freud's concept of a punitive superego, to an understanding that conscience is based in our normal and positive relatedness to one another. As an intervening sense of responsibility seated in our emotional attachments, conscience has evolved into a purely psychological construct. But in a kind of philosophical full circle, back to its beginnings in the church, conscience is also the place where psychology and spirituality meet, an issue on which the recommendations of psychology and the teachings of the major religious and spiritual traditions of the world completely concur. In a remarkable confluence, even the radical materialists and the mystics in a tacit meeting of the minds, behavioral science, evolutionary psychology, and all traditional theologies agree that having a strong conscience is extremely advantageous, and that not having one at all most commonly leads to disaster for groups and also for individuals. A psychologist would say that when we take some responsibility for the welfare of others, our actions feel natural or egocentric, and our own life satisfaction is enhanced. The Bible says simply, it is more blessed to give than to receive. As a psychologist, I can tell you that the absence of an intervening sense of responsibility based in emotional attachment is associated with an endless, usually futile, preoccupation with domination and results in substantial life disruption and eventual deterioration. Buddha puts it this way, all that we are is the result of what we have thought. If a man speaks or acts with an evil thought, pain follows him. If a man speaks or acts with a pure thought, happiness follows him, like a shadow that never leaves him. In their psychological study of individuals with exceptional conscience, Ann Colby and William Damon write, "A positivity that includes optimism, love, and joy is closely linked with morality, as we see in the lives of our exemplars." Buddha again agrees. He says, to walk safely through the maze of human life, one needs the light of wisdom and the guidance of virtue.
And of course, there is the Golden Rule, which is humankind's most ancient ethic of reciprocity, and perhaps the most succinct and clearly operationalized moral philosophy ever conceived. Confucius was merely recording an even older Chinese saying when he wrote, "Do not do to others what you would not want done to you." And when Jesus said, "Do unto others as you would have them do unto you," he was referring to an already time-honored Jewish proverb that instructed, "What is hateful to you, do not to your fellow man." This is the law. All the rest is commentary. The Mahabharata tells followers of Hinduism, "This is the sum of the Dharma. Do not unto others which would cause you pain if done to you." And in indigenous traditions as well, the Yoruba of Nigeria say, "One going to take a pointed stick to pinch a baby bird should first try it on himself to feel how it hurts." And the Lakota religious leader, Black Elk, taught, "All things are our relatives. What we do to everything, we do to ourselves. All is really one." The smattering of religions that do not adhere to moral reciprocity are contemporary and tend to make the moral warmth of the ancient Golden Rule seem even more attractive by their own blood-chilling nature. As an illustration, one can cite the Creativity Movement, a militantly anti-Semitic and anti-Christian group formerly called the World Church of the Creator, which is a religion founded on the love of the white race and the prescribed hatred of everyone else. Within this doctrine, everyone who is not white is by definition a member of one of the mud races. The central moral precept of the Creativity Movement is expressed as follows: what is good for the white race is the highest virtue. What is bad for the white race is the ultimate sin. Unsurprisingly, the long-term goal of the Creativity Movement is to organize the white race to achieve world domination. In welcome contrast, most religions and spiritual traditions subscribe to the Golden Rule, and also to some form of Black Elk's belief that all is really one. Oneness is a more fundamental tenet for some religions than others. For example, while the Judeo-Christian tradition instructs its followers to love their neighbors, Eastern mysticism teaches that individuality, the ego, is an illusion to begin with, that we are not distinct from God or from one another, and therefore, in a spiritual sense, we are our neighbors. In Peace is Every Step, Vietnamese Buddhist master Thich Nhat Hanh tries to explain this aspect of Eastern thought for Westerners by telling us that we inter are. We are ineluctably and inextricably bound up with everyone and everything in the universe, and this state of interbeing is the reason we should not selfishly and vainly chase our goals of individual acquisition and power. Though less conspicuously, a belief in oneness is part of the Judeo-Christian tradition as well. In 1939, as yet another shattering attempt at world domination rumbled in Europe, Jewish theologian and philosopher Martin Buber addressed the National Conference of Palestinian Teachers in Tel Aviv. He concluded his address by saying, "Nothing remains but what rises above the abyss of today's monstrous problems, as above every abyss of every time, the wing beat of the spirit and the creative world. But he who can see and hear out of unity will also behold and discern again what can be beheld and discerned eternally. The educator who helps to bring man back to his own unity will help to put him again face to face with God." In whatever tradition they occur, spiritual practices focused on an awareness of interbeing tend to have the intriguing psychological side effect of bringing significant earthly happiness to their most devoted practitioners, almost regardless of external circumstances. In a book that is a collaboration between psychologist Daniel Goleman and His Holiness the Dalai Lama, entitled Destructive Emotions, A Scientific Dialogue with the Dalai Lama, Goleman writes, "The very act of concern for others' well-being, it seems, creates a greater state of well-being within oneself." In recent years, increasing numbers of scientists have echoed this impression. At a 2002 conference on science and the mind attended by the Dalai Lama, distinguished Australian neurobiologist Jack Pettigrew remarked, "If you go to Dharamsala, Indian home of the Tibetan community in exile, you go up through the fog in midwinter and you come out in the bright sunshine. It's like going to heaven."
What strikes you immediately is the happy, smiling faces of the Tibetans who don't have much, have been terribly deprived, and yet they are happy. Well, why are they happy? The Dalai Lama himself is interested in answering this question scientifically and in finding a secular way to create the compassionate sense of interbeing that is achieved by devout practitioners of Tibetan Buddhist meditation. To this end, he has launched an international series of dialogues between scientists and Buddhist scholars, the most recent of which, in 2003, was co-sponsored by the Mind and Life Institute in Colorado and the McGovern Institute of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He intends these dialogues to yield practical solutions to the destructive states of mind that both the Buddhists and the scientists view as the root of human conflict and suffering. As a psychologist, I am particularly taken with the Dalai Lama's description of those whom I might refer to as sociopaths, or as people devoid of an intervening sense of obligation based in connectedness to others. He refers to such individuals as people who don't have well-developed human lives. More specifically, the Dalai Lama said of the World Trade Center attacks, "Technology is a good thing, but the use of technology in the hands of people who don't have well-developed human lives can be disastrous." To the extent that a person's capacity to have a well-developed human life is facilitated or limited by his or her particular gray matter, this Buddhist conception of sociopathy highlights what is one of the most interesting confluences of all, that between religion and neuropsychology. Perhaps sociopathy is a life lesson that is taught not by some physical facility or limitation, but by an emotional debility. In other words, some people must learn what it is like to live with extreme beauty, or no legs, or as a beggar, and others, those with no conscience, must learn what it means to live without being able to care about others. There is an irony here, in that this karmic state, if you will, may indeed be a reason to find sociopaths pitiable, as we might pity blind orphans, whether or not we believe in the devices of karma. Though psychology recognizes the value of compassion and of sensing oneness, psychologists have so far not researched any direct methods to achieve these, thus leaving sociopaths, and especially our healthier disciples, somewhat in the lurch where the heightening of conscience is concerned. As ways to increase life satisfaction, psychologists increasingly recommend moral education for normal children and giving and volunteerism for adults. But psychologists have traditionally been much more interested in endeavors such as strengthening interpersonal boundaries and assertiveness training. In this regard, psychology relative to spirituality reminds me of the hungry traveler in an ancient parable from India called The Wise Woman's Stone. A version of this parable, the author of which is long lost to antiquity, can be found in a collection of stories compiled by Arthur Lenihan, published in 1994 by, ironically, the Economics Press. A wise woman who was traveling in the mountains found a precious stone in a stream. The next day, she met another traveler who was hungry, and the wise woman opened her bag to share her food. The hungry traveler saw the precious stone and asked the woman to give it to him. She did so without hesitation. The traveler left, rejoicing in his good fortune. He knew the stone was worth enough to give him security for a lifetime. But a few days later, he came back to return the stone to the wise woman. "I've been thinking," he said. "I know how valuable the stone is, but I give it back in the hope that you can give me something even more precious. Give me what you have within you that enabled you to give me the stone." The wise and happy Tibetan Buddhists, and certainly the Dalai Lama himself, are reminiscent of Kolbe and Damon's exemplars of extreme conscience, such as Susie Valadez, who feeds the poor in Mexico, and former college president Jack Coleman, who tries to foster his own sense of interbeing and compassion by being a ditch digger, a garbage collector, a homeless person. Both the Buddhist monks and the psychological exemplars illustrate that the awareness provided by extreme conscience improves people's lives and makes them happy. This happiness is not the product of any cognitive strategy or reattribution of temporary failures to the cosmos and long-term successes to oneself. In fact, Kolbe and Damon report that most of their moral exemplars are insistent realists, regarding the circumstances of human life and their own limited potential to alter these conditions. No, rather than mere cognitive adaptation, exceptional conscience involves the strong and steadying sensation of being part of something greater than oneself. Indeed, conscience would seem to be the nexus of psychology and spirituality, as revealed by what psychologists now know about the singularly uplifting effects of a moral sense based in emotional connectedness. In religion and spirituality, the experience at this locus is called by names such as oneness, unity, interbeing. In psychology, it is called conscience or the moral sense. Whatever its name, it is a powerful integrator of human thought, emotion, and action that knew its origins in our primeval biological past. Through our genes, our brains, and perhaps our very souls, it has become a protective, productive, and mood-sustaining force in our psychological and social lives, and for thousands of years has spoken to our most transcendent traditions and to the most admirable members of our race. Conscience is the still, small voice that has been trying since the infancy of our species to tell us that we are evolutionarily, emotionally, and spiritually one, and that if we seek peace and happiness, we must behave that way. Conscience, and uniquely conscience, can compel us out of our own skins and into the skin of another, or even into contact with the absolute. It is based in our emotional ties to one another. In its purest form, it is called love. And wonderfully, both mystics and evolutionary psychologists, who concur on not much else, agree that people by their normal nature are more likely to be loving than malevolent. This conclusion signifies a breathtaking departure from our usual, more cynical view of ourselves. Theologians and scientists agree also that the human mistakes tending to contravene our normally benevolent nature are twofold. The first mistake is the desire to be personally in control of others and of the world. This motivation involves the illusion that domination is a worthwhile goal, an illusion that is most fixed in the sociopathic mind. And the second tragic error is moral exclusion. We know there to be endless danger in deciding that the other is something less than human, the other gender, the other race, the foreigner, the enemy, and perhaps even the sociopath himself, which is why the question of what to do with the moral outlaw is such an uneasy one in theology and also in psychology. How do we face the potentially cataclysmic challenge of people who simply don't have well-developed human lives? So far, psychology has left this question completely unanswered, though it would seem an ever more pressing issue as time goes by and technology is proliferated. After all, the devil is evolving too. As for the question of who is more fortunate, the person ruthlessly engaged only in exactly what he wants to do, or you, who are obligated by your conscience, once again, I ask you to imagine what you would be like if you had no seventh sense. But this time, as you envision your huge influence and wealth, or your permanent leisure without guilt, imagine it while bearing in mind what conscience and only conscience can bring to a life, what it has brought to yours. Picture clearly the face of someone you love more than all of your earthly possessions, someone for whom you would run headlong into a burning building if this were required of you, a parent, a brother, a sister, a dear friend, your life partner, your child. Try to picture that same face, a parent's or a daughter's or a son's, weeping in grief, or smiling in peace and joy. And now imagine for a moment that you could look forever and feel absolutely nothing, no love, no desire to help, or even to smile back. But do not imagine this careening emptiness too long, though it would stretch throughout a lifetime if you were a person without conscience, someone who could guiltlessly do anything at all. Rather, return to your feelings. In your mind, see the face you love, touch a cheek, hear the laughter. Conscience blesses our individual lives with just this kind of meaning every day. Without it, we would be emotionally hollow and bored, and would spend our days pursuing repetitive games of our own misguided creation. For most of us, most of the time, conscience is so ordinary, so daily, and so spontaneous that we do not even notice it. But conscience is also much larger than we are. It is one side of a confrontation between an ancient faction of amoral self-interest that has always been doomed, both psychologically and spiritually, and a circle of moral minds just as ageless.
As a psychologist and as a citizen of the species, I vote for the people with conscience, for the ones who are loving and committed, for the generous and gentle souls. I'm most impressed by those individuals who feel, quite simply, that hurting others is wrong and that kindness is right, and whose actions are quietly directed by this moral sense every day of their lives. They are an elite of their own. They are old and young. They are people who have been gone for hundreds of years, and the baby who will be born tomorrow. They come from every nation, culture, and religion. They are the most aware and focused members of our species, and they are, and always have been, our hope. This concludes The Sociopath Next Door by Martha Stout. Please visit our website, www.tantor.com, for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers, or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalog.